No cable, just streaming. It's a queue on the screen all weekend. Pick the right click, can't go wrong. Gonna watch Netflix all night long. No cable, just streaming. It's a queue on the screen all weekend. Pick the right click, can't go wrong. Gonna watch Netflix all night long.
Leaving from the club just so I can watch my flicks.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that is secretly a New Cloverfield movie, Film Book Cast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who the studio sold out to Netflix for a bundle of money.
Mike DiCrescio.
How you doing today, Mike?
I am doing well. I am excited for our future in the Cloverfield franchise.
Right?
It's going to be big.
It's going to be big, man. Nobody knows that they are Cloverfield until they are Cloverfield. And then suddenly they're Cloverfield. It's crazy.
It turns out we're all Cloverfield.
It turns out the real Cloverfield was the friends we made along the way. If you've never listened to Cloverfield Cast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately, and then after that we'll move on into our featured review. This week we are discussing the new film from director Julius Onna, and the third film in the Cloverfield series, which was a surprise release, came out very suddenly. Nobody knew this was coming out until the Super Bowl. And it kind of like took film Twitter by storm. Like, everybody's like, oh my God. So for some background, and we'll talk about this more when we actually review the episode, this started out as a movie called God Particle. And we've known that God Particle would probably be a Cloverfield movie for many years at this point. But the movie kept getting delayed and we didn't really know what was going on. It wasn't officially a Cloverfield movie yet. And then there was rumors for a few weeks that it might hit Netflix. But again, there was just nothing. And then suddenly during the Super Bowl, there's a trailer for a new Cloverfield movie, The Cloverfield Paradox, and it was announced that it was hitting right after the Super Bowl. It was a day-and-date release, which I don't think has ever happened for a movie before. I don't think it was ever possible before now.
It couldn't have been possible, yeah. So.
So that's pretty insane, and we're going to get into that a lot in our review, I'm sure. But for now, Mike, let's move on into some film news. All right, it's time for some film news here on Film Bookcast, and we begin with some news that we kind of touched on in our last episode when we reviewed The Post. We had some late-breaking news during that episode that a poster had gone online that was a casting call for an adaptation of West Side Story directed by Steven Spielberg and written by Tony Kushner. And now we have a little more details about what that is. It's West Side Story. That's exactly what it is. But yeah, it seems like that's going to be Spielberg's next two movies are West Side Story and Indiana Jones 5. Those are the next two.
I mean, that's exciting. I'm down.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. I mean, a musical is one of the very few things that Spielberg has not done up to this point. However, he does have one of my favorite musical moments in all of film, which is the opening of Temple of Doom.
Wait, hold on.
Someone hasn't seen Temple of Doom recently enough, it seems like.
It's been a long time, Mike. Refresh my memory.
The opening of Temple of Doom is they're in, I think, Thailand, I want to say, or they're in some kind of Asian country. You know, it's kind of that James Bond-esque opening where Indiana Jones is, like, is poisoned, and the guy's like, oh, we have the antidote to the poison you just drank, and all that, before erupting into a big action scene. But right before that, it opens up with the opening titles and stuff, and it's Willie Scott, Kate Capshaw in the movie, doing, like, a performance of Anything Goes.
Oh wow, yeah.
And it's amazing. It's so good. And I've always loved that sequence. And so the fact that Spielberg's going like full on musical, like that's pretty exciting to me. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's something, like you said, it's something new. And, you know, at 77, 76, how old is he? He's getting up there.
He's in 70s, yeah.
Yeah, why not? Why not do something new?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I love about Spielberg. He's always trying to do new stuff. And so I mean, it's new in a relative sense of the word because this is a remake of West Side Story. But it's new to him. Like, he'll be doing a musical, which, you know, for him, as a filmmaker, he was growing up in a time when musicals were all over the place. You know, 50s and 60s, they were huge. And so I think this is probably an itch that he's wanted to scratch for a very long time. So I'm pretty excited about that. And then Indiana Jones 5 is definitely, I think that's the one he's shooting next, actually, and then he's shooting West Side Story. But I'm guessing West Side Story will come out first, just because I doubt that takes as much, like, post-production work as Indiana Jones would. But,
right.
But we'll see what happens.
Who knows? Maybe it's aliens now. We don't know.
It's just aliens?
It's not Sharks and the Jets. It's the Sharks and the Aliens, Mike.
Okay. So I think what you're saying is that they're going to combine West Side Story and Indiana Jones 5.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's what I'm getting at. They take place in the same time, maybe. I don't remember. Where the hell does West Side Story take place?
Present day? Like, I mean, for then, it's 1960, but present.
Okay,
like,
fair.
It's, you know, I don't think it's a time-specific, you know, story. Indiana Jones is more period-specific. That's got to be, like, I mean, now it has to be, like, the 60s, even 70s.
We're getting there.
I would love if Indiana Jones 5 ends in 1981, and it's... In 1981, and it shows Indiana Jones walking into an adaptation of his life, and it's Raiders of the Lost Ark. That is the way to end the Indiana Jones franchise.
Oh, my God. This written by Dan Harmon.
This is irrefutable. Don't at me. So, yeah, I wanted to bring that up because I'm just excited about the new projects that Spielberg has coming up. Of course, The Post just came out. Ready Player One is out in, like, 2 months, and then he's got these movies to go into. So, pretty exciting stuff. And then I also wanted to bring up another one of my favorite directors. Just got attached to adapt whatever. Mike, you're more familiar with this than I am, so let us know what this is. The King Killer Chronicles.
Yes, this is a series of fantasy novels. Written by Patrick Rothfuss, and they're pretty, it's insane that this person is attached to direct him.
Right. So yeah, did I say the person? I don't think I did.
I don't think you did. You said one of your favorite directors.
Sam Raimi is attached to direct, yes. The King Killer Chronicles, director of the Evil Dead movies, the Spider-Man movies, one of my all time favorites. And so yeah, the King Killer Chronicles, what is this? It's a book series?
Yes. Yeah. It's a series of, novels. There's two out so far. We've been waiting on the third one. We're kind of getting, George R.R. Martin by, okay. Rothfuss right now. But that's okay. You know, work at your own pace, man.
Sure.
Yeah, and it's a series. It follows the story of a man named Kavoth, and just to hit the chronicles of his life. And it's interesting that Raimi is directing it because he's known, you know, he's got one of the most unique styles of directing and filmmaking, kind of goofy and campy and all that stuff. And King Killer Chronicles isn't really like that. It's
really?
It's a pretty straightforward like. As hard fantasy, quote unquote, you know, you can get, like, you know, how The Martian was hard science fiction kind of thing. Like, it goes through great lengths to explain, like, why magic works the way it does. And, like, it's kind of like a weird science thing. But it's interesting that Raimi's in it, is involved. I'm down.
Yeah.
I mean, the big draw and one of the most important facets of King Killer Chronicles is the importance of music and the story and what that plays and what it means to the main character. And Lin-Manuel Miranda is attached to, I think, write the music and the movie and, like, maybe star in it. It's like a whole thing.
I'm a little unclear on what his role is, but yeah, he is involved in this somehow. Because I think what they're also doing, I think they're developing a TV series as well as a movie. And I think he's more directly involved with the TV show, but he's also producing the movie. But he's writing the music for both. Like, I really don't know, because I don't know anything about this series of books or anything like that. So I can't say for sure what their roles are.
Yeah.
But the fact that Lin-Manuel Miranda and Sam Raimi are working on the same project, like, that's pretty exciting to me, because they're two of my favorite people.
And if you enjoy fantasy stuff, which I know you sort of do.
I do, yeah, very much.
Yeah, so, like, it's a weird confluence of events and names and stuff that I'm into.
Okay.
And hopefully they can just make it real good.
That's the dream. That's the dream. Now, yeah. Patrick Rothfuss is a name that I know, but I don't know where I know it from. Is there something else besides King Killer Chronicles that he's done?
Not really. Okay. He's written other, like, short stories. He's an author primarily, but he's kind of just permeated nerd culture at this point. Like,
he might be like an active Twitter presence. Is that what
he's really big in, like, book Twitter or whatever, you like, you know, it's along with Sam Sykes and, like, those kind of people. And he's kind of invaded, you know, he's gotten involved with D&D and a lot of Penny Arcade stuff, you know, things like that. So he's just kind of around. He's a big internet presence on top of having written these novels.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so this is definitely a project that we're going to keep an eye on for sure. A huge level of talent drawn to the King Killer Chronicles. Let's move on to this next bit of news. Mike, have you ever seen Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ?
You know, honestly, I haven't.
You know what? Neither have I. I actually own Passion of the Christ on DVD. Never watched it.
Never watched it. Interesting.
But get ready, because Mel Gibson is back for Passion of the Christ 2, and he's bringing along Jesus with him. Jesus...
JC, my boy?
Yeah, he couldn't get actual Jesus, so he got Jim Caviezel, right, which is, you know, a pretty good backup. Jim Caviezel, of course, played Jesus in the original Passion of the Christ. So I think this one's called The Resurrection of the Christ. It'll be about, obviously, the next stuff in the... pretty sure Passion of the Christ leaves off where Jesus dies. But that's not... I mean, obviously, there's more to that story. You got a built-in sequel right there. Yeah, so that's something. I mean, Passion of the Christ was a monster hit when that happened. Remember that? Like,
yeah.
I remember, I never saw the movie, but I remember that just being huge when that came out. I think it was the highest grossing R-rated movie of all time.
Yeah, I remember, I was in Catholic school, and I remember, like, other Catholic schools in the area, like, taking the school to go see Passion of the Christ in theaters and stuff.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
So I did want to bring that up because this seems like major news. It seems like it's pretty much firmly cemented the comeback of Mel Gibson in terms of Hollywood.
He's now making
a sequel to arguably his Braveheart's probably his biggest hit, but Passion of the Christ was certainly a cultural phenomenon in its own right. And I also wanted to bring it up because so often we get to say Simpsons did it. Whenever, you know, something like this happens, we very rarely get to say Family Guy did it.
But
Family Guy has a very famous bit. I think it was actually, that was like the first episode where Family Guy came back from cancellation, where the entire episode hinges on Peter trying to get a copy of Passion of the Christ to crucify this, starring...
That's what my ex-wife said.
Oh, the son of God, you sure are a son of a... Whoa!
Chris Tucker and Jim Caviezel? Is that it? The guy from the first one? Passion of the Christ 2. Crucify this.
Starring Jim Caviezel and Chris Tucker.
Right. I was trying to remember what the subtitle was in that bit, and I couldn't remember what it was.
And I could probably recite that whole bit from memory. I watched it so many times. It's like Chris Tucker going, they're like driving, and Chris Tucker's like, "You're crazy, Jesus! You're crazy!" And Jesus is like, "Yeah, it's what ex-wife said." And Chris Tucker's like, "You know, for the Son of God, you sure are a son of a whoa!" And then the car like jumps. It's pretty great, and I think is probably a worthy substitute to Passion of the Christ 2 if you choose not to go see this new one.
Yeah, we've already got it. We got the perfect version. We don't need any more.
We got the gist. Anyway, one more bit here before we get into the really big news. Mike, are you a fan of Men in Black, the franchise, or at least just the first movie?
I've been known to dabble.
I've been known to dabble in Men in Black from time to time. Yeah, I mean, I really like that first Men in Black movie. The first Men in Black is really good. Second one is terrible. And then the third one, it has its moments. You know, I'm kind of lukewarm on the sequels, but the first one's really good. But what gets you through the entire franchise is that Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones are so good together.
Humans, for the most part, don't have a clue. They don't want one or need one either. They're happy. They think they have a good bead on things.
Why the big secret? People are smart. They can handle it.
A person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it. 1,500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was the center of the universe. 500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was flat, and 15 minutes ago, you knew that people were alone on this planet.
Imagine what you'll know tomorrow.
Would you be interested in Men in Black if Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones were not in the movies, perchance?
Mayhaps.
Mayhaps.
Is there an offer you'd like to make?
I can tell you, I can't tell you who's in it, because we don't know that yet, but...
Then what's the point? No, I'm kidding.
But I can tell you who's directing it. F. Gary Gray has been hired to reboot Men in Black for a new generation.
All right.
Yeah, and so F. Gary Gray, director of The Italian Job, the director of Straight Outta Compton, most recently director of The Fate of the Furious, is doing this Men in Black movie. And yeah, I mean, sure. Like,
yeah, why not at this point?
I was much more into the idea of Men in Black crossing over with the 21 Jump Street universe.
Why are they so desperate to get Men in Black back into movies? I guess because they're really successful.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I feel like they're only really successful because, you know, it's Will Smith.
Yeah.
You know, that was kind of his big... Men in Black was kind of his big franchise, really. Like, there wasn't a... You know, I feel like Will Smith had a great blockbuster career. Maybe Bad Boys is the other big franchise, but there was only two of those. There was three of Men in Black. But, you know, he was the biggest thing in the world for a while, Will Smith.
Yeah.
And he hasn't really had, like, a big hit in a long time. You know, he's resorting to starring in Bright on Netflix now. That's, like... That's what he's doing. I guess he was in Suicide Squad, but that's more of an ensemble thing. And, like,
yeah.
You know, it did make a lot of money, but it was, you know, generally considered a disappointment. So I don't know, man. I think if they really wanted to, they could probably try to get Will Smith back for Men in Black 4. It would be the worst thing in the world, right?
He'll be in Rip Torn's position, like the chairman or whatever. That's not his character's name, but like the guy that runs the order or whatever.
That would actually be perfect. Rip Torn died in Men in Black 3. That like opened with his funeral or whatever. So yeah, that would actually work out really well. And then you can be like a handing of the torch kind of thing.
Yeah,
it would be the Force Awakens of Men in Black movies.
that's what they should call it.
Yeah, Men in Black: The Force Awakens.
Yes,
just not even try to disguise it. Daisy Ridley is one of the agents, and actually honestly, if it was John Boyega and Daisy Ridley as the new Men in Black, like I'm in.
Holy shit,
that would be amazing.
I'm in. Sign me up.
Sign me the fuck up. Yeah, that would be dope. Anyway, and F. Gary Gray, I mean, solid director. You know, I think the reason he's been hired for Men in Black is because of his work in Fate of the Furious. He now has more experience with big action set pieces. So we'll see what happens. I really don't know if this will actually come to pass because I feel like there's not that much demand for Men in Black, especially without Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. And even Men in Black 3, like, it almost had to disguise the fact that Tommy Lee Jones wasn't really in much of it because Josh Brolin was playing his role. For most of the movie. And when Tommy Lee Jones was on screen in Men in Black 3, he was very clearly checked out. Like, he did not want to be there. Which, to be fair, is just Tommy Lee Jones, but...
Yeah. But there was also no demand for a new Jumanji movie, and look how that worked out.
And it made a buttload of money. Like, Jumanji, I actually haven't seen it yet. I'll be seeing it tomorrow, as a matter of fact. And I probably would not have seen it. Like, I would not have gone to see this new Jumanji movie if it didn't make... like $800 million, and everybody I know who saw it liked it a lot. Like,
yeah,
it's a weird case. It's a weird case. I really feel like it is a success on the level of like Jurassic World, where it's like, who could have possibly predicted this would make that much money?
Yeah.
And then in like a year from now, it'll seem so obvious in retrospect. Like, oh, well, Jumanji is a beloved property and this one had The Rock in it. And it's like, yeah. What's going to be weird about Jumanji is that this is going to like build a franchise of Jumanji movies.
There's already a third one like slated. Or yeah.
That's already in the works. And I'm sure it's going to be like, you know, a few of them. And like, you know, people years from now will have grown up on like these Jumanji movies and think of like the Robin Williams one as like a weird prologue that happened. Like,
some weird experimental film that came out that no one saw.
Like, it's so weird that Robin Williams one is also tied to these Jumanji ones that we all love so dearly.
Exactly.
Fucking millennials, man.
Said the millennial.
We do got to move on and get into the big news, Mike. This just broke yesterday, and it's big news because it's Star Wars news, and Star Wars news tends to be the biggest news. So, in the future of Star Wars, we got the Solo movie, which is coming out in a couple months, which just dropped its first trailer recently. I don't know if you saw that.
Yes.
Curious to hear what your thoughts on the Solo trailer are, but I'll get the news first. So, we got Solo coming up, Episode 9, a year later. Then, potentially, an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie a year after that. And then Rian Johnson's trilogy of Star Wars movies that he's working on.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's more.
Interesting.
Disney announced via the Star Wars website yesterday that David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, the creative voices behind Game of Thrones on HBO, are writing and producing a new series of Star Wars movies. And this is going to be separate from the main saga and separate from Rian Johnson's trilogy.
Okay.
So, they did not specify how many movies this was, by the way. They just said a new series of Star Wars movies.
Right.
So, like, who knows? I mean, I'm guessing three.
Yeah. If anything, if Star Wars history has taught us anything, it's that movies come in three.
Exactly. But I'm curious what your thoughts are on this, Mike. Do you think this is a oversaturation of Star Wars, first of all? But do you think David Benioff and D.B. Weiss are a good fit for Star Wars?
I think it's definitely approaching oversaturation of Star Wars.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're already at oversaturation.
Yeah, I saw your tweet or retweet or whatever it was, the Homer Simpson in hell with the donuts image. Said, you like Star Wars, have every Star Wars forever, or whatever it is, or something like that.
Well, you like Star Wars, do you? Here's all the Star Wars in the world! And just Homer eating donuts. And like...
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel. But that said, I don't know how to feel about this. I was kind of one of the people that after the whole Confederate thing, got lukewarm on these guys.
Yeah,
I am interested. I think I will. My reaction will. I'll have a stronger opinion of it after season 8, 7. I can't even remember. Eight.
The final season of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, the final season of Game of Thrones. After I see how they handle that, I think I will be more compelled to have feelings, I guess, about this. Because it does – it's real weird. They're two dudes that I definitely wouldn't peg to put in a family-friendly franchise.
I mean, they are like screenwriters who have done other stuff besides Game of Thrones, you know, in the past. And I don't really know I don't have their filmographies listed in front of me right now, so I can't really say what it is. But yeah, I think they can adapt to a Star Wars thing. And I think the idea, like, they're pretty good at building something from this world. And they've already taken an established fantasy world and kind of built their own thing from it. And they've done so, like, doing very complex stuff with their characters and building, like, this intricate tapestry of relationships and history that feels very lived in. And I feel like that could be very valuable for a Star Wars franchise. But it's very tough to know how much of that is them and how much is what George R. R. Martin had already written down. And what they just built from that. So it'll be interesting. And this will be, like, separate from main trilogy, separate from Rian Johnson. Supposedly this will be, like, all new stuff, like Rian Johnson's thing, which is a great direction for Disney to be moving in, because the Solo trailer just came out, and I thought it was solid. Like, it looked fine, you know.
Yeah. I can't believe they admitted the movie's coming out.
Yeah.
I honestly thought that we weren't going to see shit.
You think they would?
I thought they were going to Cloverfield. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought they were going to Cloverfield us.
That was one of my tweets. The other day was, it's only a few months from now when we all walk into the theater and then find out the title is actually Solo, A Cloverfield Story.
Get ready.
Thought we were in trouble there for a second, but it's fine. We're fine.
Oh, man. Your tweet, very underappreciated, man.
Thank you.
That's amazing.
Thank you. You can all follow me at M. Smith Film Blog for more gems like that. But yeah, and I think, you know, Solo, I think... will probably turn out fine. And I think the trailer looks fine. And, you know, they want to do this Obi-Wan movie. Like, maybe that'll happen, sure. But I think with this Rian Johnson trilogy and with this, I think Disney's finally taken the message of, like, we should probably do other things with Star Wars than just rehash old shit. And I think they might have learned their lesson from Solo, because they had so many problems with Solo behind the scenes. You know, they had Phil and Chris Miller making it for most of his thing. Then they, you know, got fired, and they reshot, like, 80% of the movie, and... So I think overall, Solo will probably be fine, you know, but I think it has forced Disney to look at this franchise in a new light, maybe, hopefully.
Yeah. The big complaint, of course, is, you know, why more white dudes? Why that, though? Why?
I mean, I get that for sure. Although, to be clear, they're not directing these movies. They're just writing them.
Right.
So we do not know who will be directing. I could totally see somebody from Game of Thrones getting in on this, one of their stable of directors. Michelle MacLaren is right there. Like, she absolutely deserves a Star Wars movie. She's the best TV director working right now. She's worked on Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. I think she worked on Westworld too, and I think she did a couple leftovers. Like, she's been all over some of the best shows on TV. She was supposed to direct Wonder Woman originally, and then dropped out over creative differences, and then Patty Jenkins kind of swooped in. So I would love to see, you know, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss write a Star Wars movie that Michelle MacLaren directs. Like, that would be pretty insane.
That'd be pretty dope, yeah.
But also, more to the point, I also feel like we won't see these movies for many, many years. Like,
yeah, that's also fair.
Yeah, because, I mean, we're not getting Game of Thrones until next year, right? Like,
yeah.
That's happening, like, in 2019, so they're not going to be done with that for a little while. But then they have to actually write like a new movie, and then a movie has to be made, and you know it's going to take some time. So I don't really know what the future of Star Wars is beyond Episode IX, outside of these vague trilogies from Rian Johnson and from David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. But I think they're pretty I really love Game of Thrones. I think they've done a really great job with that show. So I'd be curious to see what they do with Star Wars. At this point, it almost feels inconsequential for me to say like, yeah, I'll see what they do with Star Wars. Cause like, I'll see what anybody does with Star Wars. It's Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to see Solo, same as everybody else.
Yeah.
I'm still annoyed that Phil Lord and Chris Miller were kicked off, but you know, I'm going to see it, you know,
it's still
going to
be there. Yeah.
Yeah. And even I got to say the trailer looked fun. Like there was some fun stuff. Actually, I did want to say the very end of the trailer, kind of got my hopes up a little bit, because there was like one bit where Han flips the Falcon and knocks a TIE fighter into an asteroid, and I was like, all right, that's pretty cool.
That was pretty dope. Yeah,
and then Han has a line like towards the end where it's like, oh, I thought we were going to be in trouble there for a second, but it's fine. We're fine. And like that just felt like a very Han Solo-y line, and it felt right, you know? And it's very difficult to judge what Alden Ehrenreich will be like as Han Solo from like a minute and a half trailer, but I thought like from what I got from the trailer, like he looked solid in the role, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought he was perfectly fine. Like I was afraid he was going to be doing an impression of Harrison Ford. That would have been,
that would have been the game over. Yeah. See you later.
Yeah, because there's no way you can just be Harrison Ford. You got to make the character your own. So, you know,
everyone knows we're all going to really just be there for Lando in that fur coat, though.
Oh, yeah. That's that movie's being sold on two images of Lando in a fur coat, and that's all you need.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very much the prevailing sentiment after that Solo trailer was maybe they should have just made a Lando movie. They got Donald Glover, man. They should have just made it a Lando movie, which was funny because one of the first images I saw right after that sentiment came out was Bradley Whitford's character from Get Out being like, you know, I think they should have made a Lando movie.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I would have voted for Lando for mayor of Cloud City 3 times if I could have.
Let's just move on.
Okay, yeah. So I think that wraps up film news for today, Mike. Let's move on into our discussions.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, here we go. It's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Now, Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
I have a few movies to discuss today.
Oh, boy.
I'll start with the newest one, or the most important, air quotes.
Okay.
And that is Darkest Hour, I guess, since it's directed. Well, I mean, it is directed by a human named Joe Wright.
Oh, you got one of those human-directed films.
One of the human movies, Mike. They got moving pictures now, son.
He will be reasonable.
When will the lesson be learned? When will the lesson be learned? How many more dictators must be wooed, appeased, good God, given immense privileges, before we learn? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
I was going to say nominated for Oscars.
Yes, nominated for Best Picture. Gary Oldman possibly going to win Best Actor for Darkest Hour.
He stars playing Winston Churchill. And goddamn, yo, Gary Oldman's real good at being a different person.
I'm sure he is. Yeah. Now we were going to review, debating what we're going to review in this episode. Right. And we kind of got lucky with the surprise release of the Cloverfield Paradox. And we're like, oh, this is a movie people are talking about. We can watch, we can do this.
We can do it.
But, we were talking about like, oh, we'll do The Shape of Water or we'll do Phantom Thread. Cause I've seen almost every movie nominated at the Oscars this year. And we haven't gotten to talk about most of them. And you were like, oh, well, I'll see one of those movies this weekend or whatever. And so I was like, great. Just let me know what you see, and then we'll do a review. And then you saw Darkest Hour, which was the one movie that I hadn't seen.
yep. Can always count on me to let you down. Yeah, but this movie follows Winston Churchill's ascent to the Prime Minister of England, of the UK, in 1940. And it takes place over 1 month, which is not what I was expecting. I kind of thought this was going to be like a traditional biopic, you know, that kind of just tells the whole life or the story.
Yeah, I usually much prefer biopics that only take place over the course of like a month or two.
A single event.
Like Lincoln, for example, Spielberg's Lincoln takes place over like 4 months, and it's like it's perfect for that. Like you don't need every bit of Lincoln's backstory; you just need to know what's going on right now.
Yeah, and it definitely lends a lot to the tension and the insane situation that he took over. Also, interesting that this the second movie this year that has all this Oscar buzz. Indirectly about Dunkirk, within the first month of his prime minister ship, that's not how that says goes, but whatever, becoming prime minister, Dunkirk and all that and what happens there happens. And it's kind of about him, about Churchill trying to deal with and understand this kind of imminent German invasion and the potential total loss of the entire British army. As you know, first day on the job, and that stuff's happening, and just about the tumultuous stuff going on in Parliament with the King and everything. And it Joe Wright manages to do this really interesting thing where he takes this, you know, historical drama. Man, I can't think of that phrase, the word when movies take place. Period piece. There we go. Jesus Christ,
you are it's late today, man.
We keep doing this late, and it's messing me up a lot. It's the story I'm going to stick to.
Yep.
So period piece, right? And he's using just like straight up modern film technique stuff. There's some crazy things. There's a moment where someone's giving a presentation, you know, at the newsreel, and they're talking about something, and they say this kind of dramatic, startling piece of information, and somebody in the meeting says, "Wait, repeat that." And the movie just literally rewinds, and they show it again, and then they just move on with that guy. That guy doesn't say, "Just repeat that." Okay. Like I don't know, they do some like cool, interesting stuff in there amidst this what could be a very dry, boring, just textbook version of a historical drama.
Cool, and that's something that Joe Wright's very good at, because he's done a lot of these before. He did like Atonement and Pride and Prejudice. I really like his version of Anna Karenina, which came out in 2012, and a lot of that movie is kind of framed as if it's like you're watching the behind the scenes of the making of the movie as well. So you're seeing like the sets move around, and you're seeing like actors like getting out of costume and stuff like that, like throughout the movie.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's a really interesting experiment. So it sounds like he's bringing a lot of that to Darkest Hour as well, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. So that's the new movie that I've seen recently. And then I want to just talk about some movies real quick that I watched on Filmstruck that were important, I guess. But first time viewing for me.
Okay.
First up was Scanners, David Cronenberg. I didn't write down the year because it's 81, I think, or something
81,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's not his first American movie, but it's the like kind of breakout American movie, I think.
That's kind of the bigger hit. I mean, he had made like a few Canadian horror movies before Scanners. I really don't know that much about like the actual box office of Scanners. I feel like it would have been like a sleeper hit, maybe.
A cult movie now.
Yeah, it might have bombed at the box office, but like the people who saw it really dug it, and like it kind of grew from there. Like I really don't know that much about that, but the imagery of Scanners is really what sticks with you. The exploding head, obviously.
Yeah, the exploding head, which is hilarious. I guess it's a slight spoiler. I like thought that was a climax. Nah, it's like the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, it happens really early on.
It's like, oh my god. So yeah, it's awesome. You know, shadow government hunting psychic ability people. I'm in body horror shit. Sign me up.
Yep.
Great. Next movie was Kronos from 1993, directed by Guillermo del Toro, his first movie. And it's vampires as only Del Toro can do.
Absolutely.
You know, Mexico City, antique shop, weird down home, you know, kind of thing. Like this family drama, also vampires. And it's creepy and gory. Ron Perlman is amazing because he's not Ron Perlman. So great, good times.
Yeah.
See Kronos is what I'm saying.
It's weird that you bring up Kronos because actually I recently watched The Devil's Backbone, another Spanish Del Toro movie from 2001, which was very good as well. It takes place during a war in like the 40s, Spanish-ish war, I forget which war it is, It's the same. It's the same war that's being fought in Pan's Labyrinth, and I'm blanking on
the Spanish Civil War.
That's probably what it is. Yeah,
I think.
But it's, you know, it's about like an orphanage, and like there's a nuclear bomb that's just kind of like is sitting there, and there's ghosts, and it's cool. It's a good time. You should,
man.
Yeah,
you should. I love that unexploded bomb. That's such a just cause. Just of course,
it's just there.
Yeah. And then the other movie I watched was Man Bites Dog. This is a Belgian movie from 1992 that was directed by Remy Belveau, André Bonzel, and Benoît Poelvoord.
Okay.
I will venture to guess.
Crushed
it. That's the one. And this is one of these movies that I see a lot of times, like on Reddit or in, you know, in articles, film criticism articles, like the most disturbing movies of all time or stuff, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this is a black and white mockumentary about this film crew following a serial killer, and which is crazy. And also absolutely hilarious, which weird that those two things go together. But that's kind of the point. It's this kind of satire of violence in media and its use and stuff like that. And, you know, the opening scene is the serial killer explaining his formulas to filling bodies with ballast to get them to stay underwater, like where when he disposes them. And it's like this really long monologue about how old people have porous bones, so you need more weight, and young people, blah, 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 like this whole thing.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to him throwing a body off a bridge, and it lands in the river, and the river's like 6 inches deep. it's just amazing. Just dumb stuff like that.
Yeah.
But also does not hold back on anything. It like goes to the, you know, documentary about a serial killer kind of level where like, yep, no, we're following him,
right?
And he's murdering people, and it also becomes a, you know, like I said, this criticism of violence in media and kind of the media's role in that. As the things escalate in the movie, the film crew gets more and more involved. Like, okay, they start helping him hide bodies, and then they start helping him hold people down, and then they start, you know, things escalate like that. Yeah. So it's pretty crazy and interesting. And if you can stomach some of the stuff, it's not like constant. It's kind of like, you know, bouts of gore and ultraviolence and yeah, disturbing imagery and stuff that just kind of happen. If you can handle that kind of thing, I definitely recommend finding Man Bites Dog somewhere.
Cool. Nice. Yeah, sounds really cool. And that wraps up your discussions, right, Mike? You're done?
Yes, yes.
Okay, cool beans. I'll get into mine then. And the first one is one that you watched as well. It's called A Futile and Stupid Gesture.
We built our own studio on Madison Avenue and hired some talented performers who would work for bus fare.
Could I have Flexi the Pocket Monkey?
No, you may not have Flexi the Pocket Monkey.
I like a sandwich on with all mayo, with red lettuce, some rye, and a little bacon and egg. Like a dream of a lot of ketchup and mustard.
Guys, I think Coach is talking about the big man. The league commissioner.
No, what I mean is, you got leukoplakia.
You start off with cute jokes and you end up with atheistic trash, like this December issue of the National Lampoon.
Yeah, so these actors don't look exactly like the real people, but come on. Do you think I look like Will Forte when I was 27? Do you think Will Forte is 27?
Yes.
Yes, and this is the new movie directed by David Wayne, who I absolutely love. He's one of my favorite comedy directors. He made one of my favorite movies of all time, which is Wet Hot American Summer. He made They Came Together and Role Models and Wanderlust, and he worked on the Wet Hot American Summer TV shows and Children's Hospital. He is awesome. He's super funny. And I was really excited about this movie. For a long time, as soon as it was announced, because this is David Wayne directing a movie about one of his comedy heroes, Doug Kenny, the co-founder of National Lampoon, who in this movie is played by one of my favorite actors, Will Forte.
And yeah.
So it's a perfect combination of things that are catered exclusively to my interest.
Yep.
So I was pretty excited for that. And now, Mike, maybe it's like a year ago, you watched a documentary about National Lampoon,
yeah,
which is also available on Netflix, called Drunk Stone Brilliant Dead. And you watched this. So how did this compare to the documentary that you watched?
It's like pretty, it, it follows a lot of the exact same moments. Yeah. You know, there's the moment when, man, the guy that's not Doug Kenny.
Henry Beard, I want to say his name is.
Henry, yeah. When he quits, like that they directly quote what he actually says from the, which okay. they talk about in the documentary. When he walks out, it's like, I've hated every second of this and fuck all of you or something like that. and he just disappears. Yeah. You know, so it was interesting to see the kind of David Wayne comedy version of these real events that they talk about in the documentary. So it's right. definitely a cool, interesting pairing.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and aside from Will Forte, I mean, this also stars Donald Gleason as Henry Beard, who is unrecognizable yes. in the role, by the way, and he's super funny. Yeah. Like, I really enjoyed his performance. But then it also has a lot of modern comedians playing these comedy people from the past, probably most notably Joel McHale as Chevy Chase, which is amazing, because obviously they start together on Community, and Joel McHale has clearly studied how to do a Chevy Chase pratfall, because he does it a couple of times, and it's always awesome. So that's pretty great. But I gotta say, the highlight for me was Thomas Lennon as Michael O'Donoghue, who, Michael O'Donoghue, like, I am in love with this period of comedy. I love, like, you know, the that era of National Lampoon and Saturday Night Live and all that stuff, like that, like the 70s period of comedy where everybody was just on cocaine all the time. It's, you know, it's a really fascinating period for me. And I love Michael O'Donoghue as a presence. And as, like, you know, I read a book about SNL a while back called Live from New York, which was the oral history that details, you know, all 40 years of SNL's history. And Michael O'Donoghue is detailed very heavily throughout those first 5 years or so, as well as Ann Beats, who also worked with him on National Lampoon. They later dated. They were writers in SNL together. And Thomas Lennon just captures him so perfectly in this movie, where, you know, he's basically insane. He's an insane person.
Yeah.
This is the bit where, like, the dynamite in the office, and it's like, this definitely happened. This definitely really happened. I would believe that happened. But what I like about this movie is that it's, you know, it's a biopic about Doug Kenny. But it doesn't treat it like it's a serious biopic. It treats it like, you know, kind of a goof almost. Like, it's a, you know, it's not like a straight parody of biopics like Walk Hard is.
Right.
And I think it kind of, like, walks a line between being a parody of biopics and also being a very sincere one. And I think for the most part, it walks that line pretty successfully. There are bits where I think it veers a little bit too much into sincerity, where I think it could have steered back a little bit. There's literally, I mean, this one bit, which almost feels weird, because Walk Hard did this 10 years ago, but there's, like, a wrong kid died kind of thing. And it's like, you know, Walk Hard did that, right? Like, you don't have to.
Right,
do that.
Come on.
Like, you're David Wayne. You've definitely seen Walk Hard, you know?
Yeah.
But, I really enjoyed this movie. Will Forte and Donald Gleason are great together. And it goes through, I mean, it goes through the creation of National Lampoon. It goes through the early years of SNL. It goes through the behind the scenes of Animal House and Caddyshack. So I think for any kind of comedy geek, it's well worth checking out. And I really love there's the framing device where Martin Mull is narrating the movie as the future Doug Kenny, even though actual Doug Kenny died in 1980. And so it kind of, like, culminates in, like, future Doug Kenny meeting, like, present day Doug Kenny, and it's very good. And, you know, towards the end, it starts using a lot of that lines of dialogue that I know for, like, famous quotes from these different comedians about Doug Kenny. One of whom, by the way, is Harold Ramis, who the guy who plays Harold Ramis in this movie is, like, pitch perfect.
Yeah, he's spot on.
He's spot on. And I think it's John Daly playing Bill Murray. He's pretty spot on, too. And they make a point to, like, when Martin Mull is introducing all these people, they make a point, like, yeah, they don't all look or sound exactly like the actual people, but hey, do you think I looked like Will Forte when I was 27? Do you think Will Forte is 27? And then you see Will Forte in the background, like, kind of, like, look into the camera. It's like, yeah. And it's like that kind of comedy movie. Like, that's kind of what I love.
I mean, there's the line at the end when the two Doug Kennys meet, and he's like, oh, so you're a narrative device. Yeah.
that's a choice.
Yeah, I don't know. That one really got me. A certain type of fourth wall break that I just really appreciate.
Yes. Yeah, so that is a futile and stupid gesture directed by David Wayne. It is a Netflix original, so it is available on Netflix right now. Just came out a couple of weeks ago. And then I got to talk about this, Mike, and I'm sorry that you had to miss this.
We got to pour one out for my homies.
Yeah, got to pour one out.
My homies is me.
Yeah, I got to pour one out for Mike. So this past weekend, I went to the Alamo Draft House. And Mike, you were supposed to go with me. This was supposed to be a trip for the two of us. Actually, it was supposed to be three people, and then one person dropped out at the last minute. I was able to replace his ticket, but then you had to drop out the day before because you got dreadfully, dreadfully sick.
Yes, I got a touch of the influenza.
Yeah. That is
it got me real good.
Yeah, that was very unfortunate. Luckily, I got a refund on your ticket, so it was all good. But all
right.
I tried to replace it. I tried to replace you. I really did. But A, you're irreplaceable. And and B, it was very short notice.
Literally like 12 hours before.
Yeah. So anyway, the marathon that I ended up going to without Mike is WrestleMania, which is the 5-movie Kurt Russell marathon at the Alamo Drafthouse in Yonkers. I was very excited about this. I've been excited about this for about a year now.
Same.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But anyway, so last year, and I think I talked about this in the podcast, I went to Hey Arnold, which was the Arnold Schwarzenegger Marathon at the Draft House. And this is something that the one in Yonkers does every year around Super Bowl weekend. They do an actor marathon. So, you know, they've done Nicolas Cage in the past, which I wish we had known about at some point. That seems like something right up our alley. We have a whole podcast dedicated to him. If you haven't subscribed yet, go do it. And, you know, they had like a Jean-Claude Van Damme one and stuff like that. They did a Schwarzenegger one last year. This year was Kurt Russell. And by the way, next year it's a Wham Pam, the Pam Grier Marathon. So mark your calendars.
Oh, shit.
Mark your calendars for that, because that's going to be dope. But yeah, so there was 5 Kurt Russell movies in a row. And it was an experience, man. It was wild.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'll go through the movies one by one. When they first started, Justin, who programs the movies at the Draft House, kind of came out and like introduced it and was like, "Yeah, we're very excited about WrestleMania." And then he talked about what they were planning to do with the marathon, and the idea behind it was to do some movies that don't get as much play at that Alamo Draft House and don't get much play in general. He talked about Kurt Russell as an icon and like how he's known very well by film geeks, but only for a select few movies, even though he's a much greater talent than just those couple of movies, you know?
Right.
So he wanted to go outside the box a little bit with this marathon, pick some movies that people might not expect. You know, it's not going to be 5 John Carpenter movies in a row, you know what I mean?
Although,
I mean, that would have been crazy. That would have been awesome.
That would have been awesome.
But, like, those are all movies I've seen already. And what I welcome in these marathons, what I really love, is seeing movies that I haven't seen on the big screen and seeing a lot of them at once, so I can like just cross them off my list real quick, you know, all at once. And it's awesome seeing a favorite on the big screen too, which is always great. But, you know, for this, it was really cool to experience some sides of Kurt Russell I haven't seen before. So we'll get right into it. The first movie was the only one that had previously played at the Draft House. By the way, these were all in 35mm film, which was nice. This had played at the Draft House about like a little less than a year beforehand. Tango and Cash.
Perret! The geezer you want's Perret. He's Perret.
Who the hell is Perret?
The bloke with me in prison. He's the governor.
Yeah, where's he now? Where's the governor?
The desert, right go after you.
Think he's telling the truth?
I don't know, but it's not raining, and he's standing in a puddle.
Disgusting.
You know, Potato Head, you just fell for the oldest routine in the book. Bad cop?
Worst cop.
From 1989. Have you ever seen Tango and Cash, Mike? Because this movie is crazy.
No, I haven't. I've heard of it. I can't remember who's the other guy in it.
Sylvester Stallone.
Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, okay. So it's Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell, and it's a buddy cop movie from the 80s. They're basically the two best cops in the city in Los Angeles, and they both get framed for this crime that they did not commit. So they both end up in jail together, and they both break out, and then they both have to get the bad guy. The bad guy's played by Jack Palance, who is deliciously over the top in this movie. And this almost feels like the last bastion of big, gigantic 80s action movies. You know, this was 1989. Yeah. I think it was actually one of the last movies released in the 80s. So it really is that. But what I really love about this, I mean, Kurt Russell is hilarious in it, and he and Stallone have an amazing chemistry. Their back and forth is fantastic. What I really love about this movie is actually Stallone, who is playing a very different kind of role than he's usually playing. Like, it's still, like, an action movie role, so it's still that. But, like, you know, you picture Stallone, you picture Rambo, you picture Rocky, you picture, like, these kind of big meathead kind of characters.
Yeah.
And his character in this movie, Tango, is much more, like, you know, sharp and quick-witted. And, like, he wears a suit and has glasses, so you know he's, like, smart.
Yeah. That's how we knew in the 80s.
Exactly. And so it's fun. And even like, and he's even like shedding his image early on in the movie. There's a bit Stallone derails this truck basically. And somebody like says to him, like, "Hey, you look like Rambo." And and Stallone like just grabs a gun and is like, "Rambo's a pussy." And he like, shoots the truck and a bunch of cocaine spills out. And so he's like, it's like definitive, like right at the beginning, like Stallone is doing like something different with this role. So I think that's pretty cool. But yeah, Tango and Cash did not get great reviews when it came out. I think it has like a 33% on Rotten Tomatoes. But it's a blast. It's a lot of fun. The action set pieces are insane. And some of the writing is just so ridiculous. Like the there's so many stretches in terms of what the... There's one line that Stallone has where he's like interrogating somebody. And the guy is eating his lunch and it's like a big plate of spaghetti. And it falls to the floor. And it falls to the floor, and Stallone like grabs him, and it's like I can tell from your diet that you're not counting your calories. Is that because you're counting all the money they gave you?
What?
To frame us, and it's like, man, like that was. Were you working on that on the way over or something? Like,
that's amazing.
But anyway, Tango and Cash is a super fun action movie, and if you love Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell, it's definitely worth checking out. Terry Hatcher is also in that movie too. And then movie number two was my favorite movie of the entire one, of the entire lineup, and it was one I'd never even heard of, Mike. I had never heard of 1997's Breakdown.
What the hell are you doing, buddy?
I was trying to get you to pull over. Didn't you see me?
Yeah.
Well, never mind. Listen, I'm looking for my wife.
What?
My wife. Where is she?
How should I know where your wife is?
I'm the guy with the Jeep. You gave my wife a ride. You were supposed to drop her off at Bell's Diner.
Not me, sorry.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. This is like a half an hour ago, for Christ's sake. You don't remember?
Look, I don't know how to tell you this, but I've never seen you before in my life.
Now, this is a movie directed by Jonathan Mostow, who is most well-known for directing Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, which I have always said is a very underrated Terminator
movie.
That's
true. I believe you have said that.
Yeah, I think I've said that on this podcast before. And this movie is incredible, dude. Like, it's I think it's one of my favorite movies now. Like, just straight up.
Holy shit. Wow.
Yeah. It is amazing. So the idea, it's just a, like, tense, tight thriller from 97. Kurt Russell plays an everyman. He and his wife are on this road trip cross country. They just got a new job and they're moving out. They're on this road trip. Their car breaks down. And when their car breaks down, this trucker comes along and, you know, offers them a ride into town. His wife takes the ride while he stays behind with the car and waits for it to cool down. And a few minutes, like 20 minutes pass, and the car starts working again, so he drives into town, can't find his wife, and his wife has disappeared, and he doesn't know where his wife is. And for a long time, it plays like an episode of The Twilight Zone or something, like just this really like long Twilight Zone episode before becoming like just gradually more insane and tense, and it's so good, man. Like the final sequence with the truck, like it's this incredible car chase. It's beautiful. It is such a good movie, and Kurt Russell is amazing in it. You know, he's like I really loved Breakdown. This is a hidden gem that everybody should watch. I think I don't think it's available on Blu-ray. It is on DVD, and I might buy the DVD on Amazon like as soon as I can. Actually, it is fantastic, and I was I saw that Breakdown's coming up. Like I saw the title Breakdown on the screen, and it said directed by Jonathan Mostow, and I recognized, like, oh, Terminator 3, Jonathan Mostow. Like, I kind of like Terminator 3. I'll see what this is. Like, yeah. And now I'm like, how is this guy not making movies all the time? Like,
Terminator 3 was that not good.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess for his career.
I guess. But yeah, I really, really love Breakdown. So this ended up being my favorite movie of the day, and I cannot recommend enough people watch Breakdown. It is so, so good.
All right.
And then we move on into a movie that I was really hoping they would play. When I was going into this marathon, this is the movie that I was hoping I would see.
Yeah, this was your pick. This was your call.
Yeah, this was the one I was real, real excited about. And we obviously, I didn't know what was going to be playing ahead of time because it's a mystery marathon. But yeah, I really wanted to see 1980s Used Cars from Robert Zemeckis.
For one thing, Rudy, I got to tell you, my horoscope says trouble brewing on the horizon. And for another thing, pal, I mean, for Christ's sake, we're fucking with the President of the United States.
Oh, fucks with us, doesn't he? Hey, come on, Jeff. You've seen how shitty business is today. Thank the Fuchs, our name is Mud. Hey, look, we had nuns protesting outside when I got here this morning.
Nuns?
Yeah. I had to have Jim turn a fire hose in.
And I knocked them motherfuckers right on their ass, too.
And so for those who don't know, Robert Zemeckis, of course, directed Back to the Future in 1985, which he co-wrote with Bob Gale. And this is that duo working together a few years beforehand in 1980. So they're still finding their like filmmaking voice. And it's just a really funny comedy. Kurt Russell plays a used car salesman, and the owner of the used car lot that he works for dies. But they pretend that he's just going on vacation or whatever so that they don't lose the car lot. And it becomes like this big like competition between the car lot place from across the street, who is owned by the brother of the guy who died. And it's just so, so good. It's so funny. It's so over the top. Some of the humor has dated somewhat, for sure. There is some misogynistic and some racist stuff thrown in there, which, you know, it doesn't play super well. But, like, this movie just has so much energy to it. That stuff kind of, like, you know, you kind of move past it and, like, move on. Kurt Russell is hilarious in this movie. This is kind of, like, around the time he was shedding his Disney image, you know what I mean? So this was like,
right.
He was, you know, a Disney child actor for most of the 60s and 70s. And then starting in like 1980, he made Used Cars. And in 81, he made Escape from New York. And that was kind of like the shedding of the official, like, okay, Kurt Russell's an action star now. Like, we can, he's not Disney's boy anymore. But yeah, this is like, I feel like he made this consciously just to break away from that Disney mold, because this is such a raunchy movie, and there's a lot of, like, you know, nudity and vulgarity and all that stuff. And, you know, this incredible, like, just set pieces that, like, Robert Zemeckis would, like, the skills that he has for these set pieces are very evident in, like, Back to the Future and stuff like that. But there's a bit towards the end when it's, like, 250 cars just, like, driving down, like, a desert highway, and Kurt Russell's on the cars, and he's jumping from car to car, and it's just, it's really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's super funny. And there's a lot of, like, really funny appearances aside from Kurt Russell. The grandpa from the Munsters plays a judge in the movie, which is cool. And Joe Flaherty from Freaks and Geeks, and also he appears at the end of Back to the Future 2. He's in this movie. So yeah, Used Cars, also really funny. That was my second favorite of the night, and I was really glad I got to see it, because this is a Robert Zemeckis movie that I've been meaning to watch for a long time, because I'm a big Zemeckis fan. So that was very cool. And then movie number four is the only one that I'd actually seen before I went to this marathon. It's a movie that I hadn't watched, though, since I was probably like 10 or 11. And that movie is 1996's Executive Decision.
And it's my opinion that Hassan is planning to use the DZ-5 and the airplane together as a tactical weapon, a sort of poor man's atomic bomb to be detonated here over Washington.
How much of this DZ-5 might he have?
I can't be exact there, sir, but I can tell you this much. If this were DZ-5, that single drop would be more than enough to kill every man in this room.
It's a lot of gusto in that delivery.
Oh, right? Yes. Yeah. Executive Decision. So this is the airplane action movie that came out the year before Con Air.
Yep.
And also the year before Air Force One, actually, oddly enough. There's a weird influx of Die Hard on an airplane action movies in the mid-90s, yeah, for some reason.
I mean, we got to do Die Hard on other places. We already did office buildings.
Right.
So, I think and airports.
I think we're going back to office buildings. Dwayne Johnson's making that movie Skyscraper. I think
No, that's him versus a skyscraper.
Yeah, that movie is actually Dwayne Johnson versus the skyscraper. Yes. Yeah, so this is a solid action movie. It's fun. I enjoyed the movie. It is, you know, there's a lot of really funny moments. It's got a really great cast that includes, like, John Leguizamo. It includes Steven Seagal, who, by the way, I had seen this movie when I was a kid, and the only thing I really vividly remembered from this movie is Steven Seagal's death scene, which happens, like, 30 minutes in. It happens pretty early on. And do you remember, you've seen Executive Decision, right?
I have, but it's same thing. I haven't seen it in 15 years and I don't remember how he dies though.
Really? That was the one scene I like vividly remember when I saw Executive Decision was the movie playing. I was like, oh man, Steven Seagal dies like real early.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's, you know, Steven Seagal and Kurt Russell are set up as like these kind of like rivals who like kind of dislike each other and like they have a history and stuff like that. And then when their plane attaches to the plane that they're trying to get onto, there's like a wind tunnel that they're all climbing up, and then it suddenly detaches, and Steven Seagal goes fucking flying. And
that's amazing.
It's the funniest thing. It's so good. But yeah, this is basically Die Hard on a plane. Kurt Russell is good in it, and what I kind of like about this movie as an action movie is that it's about Kurt Russell as a hero who is trying to avoid action as much as possible, because he's not somebody who is like combat trained or anything like that. So, and he's also in a tuxedo for basically the entire movie, which is cool.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's worth checking out if you haven't seen it. It's not like one of Kurt Russell's best action movies, but it is definitely a solid movie. And then that brings us to our final movie of WrestleMania, Mike, movie number five. And at this point, I was pretty convinced that the movie we were going to watch was Escape from New York. And the reason I thought that is because I figured, well, it's probably going to end like a big hit, right? It's got to end on something like people really know and people really like. And it would have been a good one to end the marathon on. Justin had mentioned that, the movies that were being shown after Tango and Cash had never been shown in this theater before. And I didn't think Escape from New York had been. Because I knew that I knew for a fact The Thing had screened there before. I knew for a fact that Big Trouble in Little China was screening there. It's actually screening there at the end of the month. So I was like, well, yeah, so those movies are probably out.
Yeah.
Escape from New York, that's a big hit. And that's Kurt Russell's most iconic role, Snake Plissken. So it would make sense that that would be the movie. And I was half right. because, when Justin introduced this one, he was like, yeah, so I thought this would be a fun one to end on. It's not exactly a good movie, but but it's one that I think you'll enjoy watching with this kind of crowd. And that movie was Escape from L.A.
Get this crap out of me.
I guess we've got a deal.
Nice to be working with you, hotshot.
You better hope I don't make it back. All of you.
Yeah, you were almost there.
I was almost there. I was so close. So, yeah, it's the iconic Kurt Russell role, just not the movie that you want to see that role in. Yeah, and Escape from L.A. is a movie I had not seen. So I am kind of grateful I saw it in this environment just because, it's a John Carpenter that I hadn't watched before. But I was watching it, and, I was imagining being someone in 1996 when Escape from L.A. came out, being somebody who was a huge fan of Escape from New York and was so excited to see John Carpenter and Kurt Russell return to this world, and then Escape from L.A. is what it is. And for those who don't know, Escape from L.A. is basically a really cheesy, over-the-top remake of Escape from New York in a lot of ways. So it's basically the same plot where Kurt Russell is being sent into this military war zone, and he's given this task. In the first movie, he has to find the president, and this movie, it's the president's daughter. And if he doesn't complete it within 8 hours, he's going to die. That's the idea behind both movies, and that's this one. But this one's just a lot goofier, and that can be fun. There's some fun stuff to be had in Escape from L.A. Bruce Campbell plays a plastic surgeon in Hollywood. Steve Buscemi is a really annoying Maps of the Stars guy who pops up every once in a while. And its satirical points are there. It's I don't think it's satirizing L.A. as well as it's satirizing New York. And it's definitely playing it for laughs a lot of the time. And there's just some weird sequences. There's a whole scene where Kurt Russell has to play basketball to save his life. and there's a scene where Kurt Russell has to surf from one area to another to get to where he needs to go. To watch it with this crowd, the people were having fun with it and stuff. So I was enjoying it on that level. Also, the ending of this movie is surprisingly great and surprisingly nihilistic. So wanted to give a shout out to that at least. Cause that's pretty nice. That was kind of nice to see.
Yeah, it's always good to end on nihilism.
Yeah, exactly.
Because at least it's an ethos.
Exactly. There you go. There it is. Had to sneak in that subtle Lebowski reference. I like it. But anyway, yeah, that was WrestleMania. It was a great lineup. It was a really good lineup of movies, especially those first three. But Tango and Cash, Breakdown, and Used Cars, all really great. And especially if there's any takeaway from this, watch Breakdown. Whatever you do.
That's the moral.
It is incredible, and I can't believe I'd never heard of it until this marathon. That's why I love these marathons, because I'll see stuff that I hadn't even considered before that turned out to be amazing. So that is WrestleMania, and then I had a couple other things I want to talk about in discussions real quickly. I wanted to give a shout out to Chopping Mall.
Before I open the floor, I'd like you all to meet your brand new security team, the Protector 101 series robots. 1 week from tonight at closing, the Protectors will begin their patrol of the mall.
Paul, they look like the Three Stooges.
Each assigned to one of the three upper shopping levels.
I don't know, Mary. The one in the middle has an unpleasantly ethnic quality.
Now, are there any questions?
Yes, Dr. Carrington.
So what are your machines that do besides kill criminals?
Well, first of all, Doctor, the Protectors do not kill.
I wonder if they kill cockroaches.
They could probably be programmed to.
They merely detain intruders until the computer, located on the roof, can patch into the mall phone system and send an alarm to the police.
I don't know. That guy looked awfully dead to me.
Just Neutralized.
Which is a movie from 1986, directed by Jim Wynorski, who's a guy who spent most of his career making either basic cable pornos or Sci-Fi Channel original movies.
It's the American dream.
Yeah, exactly. He's got movies like Busty Cops and also Piranaconda to his name.
We're not sure which is which.
Somebody switched the labels in these, and I don't know what's going on. But I wanted to give a shout out to Chopping Mall because this is a movie that had caught my attention a while ago, and I had just watched it for the first time recently. It's available on Amazon Prime right now, and it's just about a group of teenagers who are having a party in a mall. And the mall has recently got new security robots that go haywire and start killing all the teenagers one by one. It's produced by Julie Corman, Roger Corman's wife. And it features a couple of Roger Corman mainstays. Dick Miller shows up in this movie very briefly, which was very cool. I had a blast. I had a blast at Chopping Mall. It is ridiculous. The dialogue is so 80s, it hurts. There's like lines of dialogue where like the people are talking about the party. It's like, yeah, it's going to be awesome to the max and that kind of thing. It's like, and they're saying them like sincerely, and it's a blast. But and just the death scenes are glorious. There's, you know, a head explodes at one point. Dick Miller gets electrocuted, and you know, just really, really good stuff. So wanted to give a shout out to Chopping Mall because it's like 75 minutes, and I watched it when I was tired, and it was a perfect movie for that. And then finally, one last thing in my discussions, wanted to give a shout out to Glow, the Netflix original series, which I just finished.
I'm interested in real parts. Got $83 in my bank account, and I don't know if I can pay my gas bill.
Ruth, there's an audition. They're looking for unconventional women, whatever that means.
Hello, ladies. I'm Sam Sylvia, and this is Glow.
Sorry, what's Glow?
Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling.
And it's about the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling in the 80s, which was a real thing. You know, kind of a wrestling offshoot. But this is kind of a fictionalization of the creation of Glow. And it stars Alison Brie in the lead role as an actress who isn't getting anywhere. She's like an aspiring actress living in L.A., and it's just not working out for her. And Marc Maron plays this guy who is directing Glow and hires Alison Brie and also hires, you know, every other female wrestler. And it's, you know, a cool cavalcade of characters. And it's a really fun show. It's really entertaining. I know it's produced by Jenji Cohen, who made Orange is the New Black. And it's created by somebody else, but I'm not sure. I forget what her name is. But anyway, yeah, Glow is well worth checking out, especially if you love wrestling. I feel like this is a perfect like show for anybody who is really into wrestling. There's some really fun 80s music that plays throughout, and the character interplay is really good, especially between Alison Brie and Marc Maron. But also there's the main friendship / like enemy ship between Alison Brie and the star of the show, which is also pretty cool. Also, Ellen Wong is in this, and Ellen Wong was Knives Chow in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and... And yep. She's like, you know, barely a character. She's like an ancillary character on the show. But every time she's on screen, it's like, hey, it's Knives Chow. Yeah, she's Chinese.
Nice.
Anyway, yeah. So that's Glow on Netflix. It's an original. And I think season 2 is coming out sometime this year. Let's move on, Mike, into our feature review of The Cloverfield Paradox.
Three.
Morning, beautiful.
Two.
I'm getting sick of only seeing you on a screen.
One.
Please, God. Be on our side.
Standing by for your go.
Turn that shit on.
Fingers crossed.
What the hell is happening?
Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there.
The Earth. It's gone.
It's big, blue, full of angry people. Keep looking, you'll find it.
All right, that was from the trailer for The Cloverfield Paradox, the new movie written by Oren Uziel and directed by Julius Onna. This stars Gugu Mbatha-Raw, David Oyelowo, Daniel Brühl, John Ortiz, Chris O'Dowd, Axel Henny, Zhang Ziyi, and Elizabeth Debicki, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for The Cloverfield Paradox reads... Orbiting a planet on the brink of war, scientists test a device to solve an energy crisis and end up face-to-face with a dark, alternate reality. Now, Mike, we've talked about the Cloverfield series in the past. We reviewed 10 Cloverfield Lane back when that came out. So there are two before this. There was the original Cloverfield back in 2008. And when 10 Cloverfield Lane came out, that was kind of a huge deal, right? At least for us. Because, you know, when the first Cloverfield came out, it was released as part of this, like, long marketing campaign. Like, it was a big deal when the original one came out, right? And there were those trailers that didn't have the title of the movie on it, and you were like, what is this? And, like, that went on for months. Like, people were, like, wondering, like, what could Cloverfield be and all that stuff? Like, nobody really knew what the movie was until they were watching it. And then when 10 Cloverfield Lane came out, that was a movie that we kind of knew was being made, but we didn't know it was a Cloverfield movie until the trailer came out. That was, like, 6 weeks before it came out. Right, so that was called Valencia, I think, as Dan Trachtenberg was making it. You know, they kept referring to it as Valencia, and they were like, oh, Dan Trachtenberg's new movie, Valencia, has got a new trailer coming out. And then suddenly, like, that trailer comes out, and at the end of the trailer, it's like, Cloverfield. And everybody's like, what? what? And it was coming out 6 weeks later. And that was awesome, right? That was such a cool reveal, marketing-wise, I was interested in that movie already because, you know, I like Dan Trachtenberg and I was excited to see his directorial debut, but, like, you put the word Cloverfield on there and suddenly people were like, oh, shit! Like, this... Oh, how does this connect back to Cloverfield? Like, what? Like, how is this? And it turned out that movie didn't really connect Cloverfield, really at all. No. And what they were doing with this Cloverfield series, they were like, oh, so the plan is, like, turn these Cloverfield movies into, like, what the Halloween movies almost were going to be, right? The original plan for Halloween was, like, it was going to be, like, an anthology where, like, so there was that first Halloween, which was Michael Myers, and then, like, the next one was going to be whatever, but then, so they did Season of the Witch without Michael Myers, that failed, and then, so they went back to the Michael Myers stories, and that's kind of what Halloween became, but the original plan was to make every movie, like, a different anthology story surrounding Halloween, something like that, and so the idea was to make, like, a Twilight Zone-esque series of films, just all branded Cloverfield. And that, to me, is a great idea. Like, because then you're getting a lot of really original sci-fi out there. You just toss the name Cloverfield on it, and you'll ensure people will see it. And so that's pretty cool. But then when 10 Cloverfield Lane came out, it became a thing where it's like, oh, so now any bad robot movie in the near future that we know is happening could also potentially be a Cloverfield movie, and we just don't know it yet. So there's been a lot of, like, online sleuthing to try to figure out, like, what's the next Cloverfield going to be and stuff like that, because we knew they were trying to make more. And this movie, God Particle, has been in the conversation for that for a very long time. Like, it's basically been confirmed for a long time that this would be the next Cloverfield movie. There was no actual, like, announcement about that, but they just did. We all kind of knew. Like, anybody in film Twitter kind of knew God Particle is the new Cloverfield. Eventually, it'll get a new title. Yeah, and then, like, God Particle started getting delayed. You know, Paramount pushed to, like, April, I think, recently. Like, just recently, they pushed it to April. And then there were rumors circulating that God Particle might make a debut on Netflix. That, like, there was a few weeks of that where, like, oh, they, like, there's rumors that Paramount might not be confident in God Particle. They want to, you know, toss it to Netflix. And there's a lot of people, like, debating about the merits of that. Like, is Paramount really going to, like, make their money back on that and stuff like that? And it turned out, yes, God Particle is going to Netflix. And we all found that out together, collectively.
At the same moment.
During the Super Bowl. Now, were you watching the Super Bowl when this trailer hit, Mike?
I was not, actually, because of the touch of the influenza that got me. previously mentioned.
Well, I was watching the Super Bowl. Okay, so I was there. I was watching the Super Bowl. I was with, I was at a party. And I was talking to my friend, and then I look up at the TV, and I see clips from the original Cloverfield on TV. And I was like, wait, what? Like, and I was like, wait, are they announced? Because I should back up a little bit, because earlier in the day, on Twitter, Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma and the upcoming Wrinkle in Time, tweeted something out about the Super Bowl saying, like, film Twitter is going to lose their mind over something.
Yeah, it was like 30 seconds of the tonight will change film Twitter forever or something,
something along those lines, right? Yeah. And so I was kind of on the lookout for that. And then so I see, like, clips of the original Cloverfield. I'm like, oh, this might be what Ava DuVernay was talking about. Like, there must be announcing a new Cloverfield movie. But to that end, though, it's like, oh, they're announcing a new Cloverfield movie. Like, they've done that before. And, like, I expected it would be like 10 Cloverfield Lane, where it's like, oh, it'll come out in a month or whatever. And instead, what happened is you see these Cloverfield clips, which kind of made it look like this new movie was, like, a direct sequel to the original Cloverfield. Mm-hmm. And it's not. Just throw that out there. It's not. But you're seeing these Cloverfield clips, and it announced, like, the Cloverfield Paradox on Netflix, and it says, and it's like, oh, okay, so it's officially a Netflix movie, and Cloverfield is hitting Netflix. And then I went online, and it's like available after the big game, and I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
So not only did they announce this Cloverfield movie on Super Bowl game day, and they announced it was coming to Netflix. They also announced it just happened. The Cloverfield Paradox just hit Netflix right after it was announced, basically. You know, like 2 or 3 hours later, it was up. And that is insane, man. And I think that's, you know, part of me wonders, like, is Cloverfield a great series or is it just a great series of marketing ploys? Because so far, in terms of marketing, it's 3 for 3. Like, it's a legendary series in terms of that. But I don't know how they can possibly top that. Like, unless they
pull a U2 and we just all get this movie next. Like, they don't say anything. Yeah, like, that's the only thing left.
Yeah, there's a tweet from a guy called @ClanKitty. I don't think it's a racist guy. Don't worry about it.
But he
tweeted out this: Cloverfield, elaborate marketing campaign months prior to release. 10 Cloverfield Lane, released a month after being announced. Cloverfield Paradox, announced and released on the same day. Cloverfield 4, JJ comes to your house and chucks the Blu-ray through the window unannounced.
Yeah, like, that's it.
That has to be what happens, right?
That's all that's left.
Yeah, and David Ehrlich also had a similar tweet where it's like, you know, this 2008, that weird trailer is a Cloverfield movie. 2016, the other movie is actually a Cloverfield movie. 2018, the Super Bowl is a Cloverfield movie. 2020, a woman delivers a baby after 36 hours of labor. Doctor, congratulations, the Cloverfield movie.
Oh my god!
Yeah, it is the world has Cloverfield fever, man. There's
at least we got good memes out of it.
We got some good memes out of this Cloverfield thing. Yeah, and so the Cloverfield Paradox hit Netflix, and it was a surprise to all of us, and we were all kind of taken aback. And it kind of gave us a unique way to watch this movie because normally we're so inundated with film culture at this point. Like, we see trailers and trailers for stuff. We see critics talking about a movie 2 weeks before it comes out because they've already seen it and, like, reviewed it and stuff like that. And this, you know, there was nothing. Like, we saw a 30 second bit during the Super Bowl, and then suddenly everybody was watching this movie without any prior knowledge about what it is. And that's pretty cool. So, Mike, what were your overall thoughts on the Cloverfield Paradox?
I definitely had a interesting, I think that is a interesting experience for everyone to have. Welcome to being Unsullied. It's wonderful. But I didn't even get to see the 30-second TV spot.
Right. So you were just on Netflix and suddenly a Cloverfield thing popped up and you were like, what the fuck?
Pretty much. I saw on Twitter later on, or on Reddit or something, about like the Cloverfield Paradox and that what had happened and all that stuff.
And then it dropped like, the Radiohead album.
Yeah. And but when I opened Netflix, it's like, boom, here it is. Just hit play. So like, it was the first thing that showed up because Netflix has weird algorithms for that stuff. But my overall thoughts and experience was, this is probably the best version, the way this could have gone in terms of this movie's release. Because if people had to pay $12 bucks a person or whatever, get a babysitter, go see, you know, man, people would have been so mad. But for free, just because we got a movie for free, that's a Netflix original, and it's a goofy attempt at sci-fi horror, like, sure, like, yeah, why not? I had a lot of fun with Cloverfield Paradox.
Interesting.
I mean, it definitely didn't work on a whole lot of levels, kind of like any of them.
Yeah.
But it made me really it just really made me want to watch Event Horizon because it's such a better version of this movie.
It's Event Horizon. It's just Event Horizon.
It's like, just Event Horizon.
Yeah. I mean, the Cloverfield Paradox hitting Netflix, it does feel like, as you're watching it, this is a last ditch attempt by the studio to just recoup their losses on a film that they think will bomb, like, 100%. Yeah. And I think, you know, if they slapped the Cloverfield name on this movie and put it out into theaters, it might have made money because it had the word Cloverfield in the title. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, 10 Cloverfield Lane made a pretty decent chunk of change, so, like, there's value in this brand. But, you know, I think it might have made money, but it might have soured people on Cloverfield as a title to use, and they're planning on more. Like, there's one possibly coming out this year also, like another one.
There's like a World War II movie that they're planning that is rumored to be the next Cloverfield movie also.
Yeah, that one's called Overlord right now, but eventually it'll be called like the Cloverlord or something.
Yeah, you're probably right.
I hope it is called that, actually. That'd be amazing. But yeah, so it does feel like the studio, you know, knew they kind of had a stinker on their hands and was like, okay, so we can throw this on Netflix and people are probably more charitable to it because they don't have to go anywhere. And
yeah.
And that's kind of what happened. And it was interesting. So you watched this like that night, right? Like that, as soon as it was on Netflix?
I actually watched it Monday morning.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so yeah, I watched that Monday afternoon. And it was interesting to watch the conversation around this movie shift over just the course of a few hours. Because when it was announced, people were like, holy shit, this is like the craziest thing of all time. I can't wait to watch this Cloverfield movie. And then, you know, that was, you know, during the Super Bowl, like around like 10:30, this movie hit Netflix. And then you just see like the reactions start to come in around midnight, 1 a.m. And it's like, ooh.
Yeah.
I see why this is a Netflix movie now.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I had the benefit of hearing all that, you know, being in my fever, sleep, haze kind of thing. I didn't pay attention past hearing about it.
Okay.
So then by Monday morning, I was still like, hell yeah, let's do this. And then by Monday afternoon, after I had watched it and everyone else had also watched it, it was like, ooh. maybe not so much.
Yeah. I mean, so I will say, I mean, this never comes close to the level of the other Cloverfield movies. You know, because those are very good. I really love that first one, and I really love 10 Cloverfield Lane. I think we both put 10 Cloverfield Lane on our top 10 list that year.
Yeah, 10 Cloverfield Lane's like an incredible movie that just happens to be this Cloverfield thing.
Yes, exactly. But I think, you know, I think in both cases, I think in that movie and in this movie, I don't think they started off the Cloverfield movies. I think they started off like, you know, as just standalone movies that they threw like, you know, a monster in at the end of and made it a Cloverfield movie. And I feel like that's more felt in this movie than it is in 10 Cloverfield Lane. Whereas 10 Cloverfield Lane, like, the ending with the monster is kind of tacked on from what, like, it feels, you know, like a much different movie than you watched for the preceding, like, hour and 40 minutes, you know, those last 10 minutes. And I think it works in 10 Cloverfield Lane. I like it in that movie. But in this movie, like, all the Cloverfield stuff, it just feels weird. I mean, it just, like, I don't think they've ever said the word Cloverfield in either of the other two movies.
They say it like every 45 seconds in this movie.
Just to remind you, this is a Cloverfield movie because the name of the ship is Cloverfield.
Yeah,
that they're on. Yeah, and so that's a little weird. And you get like insert shots of like Slusho, which is the brand of soda or whatever in the Cloverfield things. But I think this never comes close to the level of those two movies. And I think this feels very rushed and incomplete in parts, and it's borderline nonsensical. Like it makes no sense. It has a completely unnecessary B plot, like just straight up. Everything on Earth is completely unnecessary to anything that happens in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it also contains one of the most laughable final shots in any movie I've ever seen. It is complete nonsense. But I think it does occasionally rise to the level of very fun, goofy trash, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
So I don't think I would have been pissed off if I saw this in the theater. I think general audiences would have been. But you know, like we said before, this is Event Horizon. It's the movie that reminded me the most of Event Horizon.
Yeah, the Cloverfield Paradox is a series of references and extended homages that don't really go together. Yes. I don't think.
Right.
And even those homages kind of just feel like ripoffs.
the way this movie treats science, it like makes you feel. It makes you really appreciate how good Interstellar is. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Like even if you think the science in Interstellar can be wonky at times, like it makes you really appreciate how good that movie is.
Yeah, and one of the other things too is there's this movie is very clearly trying to be science fiction horror, or at least wants you to recognize that it knows what that is.
Yeah.
But doesn't approach any of that, I don't think. I don't think there's any really scary horror bits that ever happen, even though we set up a bunch of them or try to do it.
Well, there's some, like, Cronenbergian horror moments.
There's definitely, like, some body horror shit going on.
Yeah.
But there's nothing, like, outright scary.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I would say, I mean, it's like I just brought this movie up in my discussions, but it's weird because the original Cloverfield feels very influenced by Escape from New York. You know, that's part of the thing with Cloverfield. Like that movie, like Cloverfield, is about an escape from New York. But it's, you know, it even has like the Statue of Liberty imagery that like the head in the street and stuff like that. And this is Escape from LA. This is just straight up. This is Escape from LA.
Yeah.
Like, just in terms of, like, the tonal shift and, like, everything. Like, because it's weird, because this movie kind of, it feels like it's playing stuff, like, for laughs a little bit, you know, for the first half or so. And it's, it feels like it knows what kind of movie it is for a while. I think that first half is a lot stronger than the second half. Like, that first half where it's just, you know, like, weird shit going on, like, you know, worms popping up and arms flying off. And, like, that, like I'm into that. I was into that. Yeah. Like, I was having fun with that. And then, like, towards the end, it kind of just becomes a lot more serious and, like, it's not as fun anymore.
It feels like you can detect the moment Cloverfield entered the conversation. Where they were like, let's make the, you know, like, Guard Particle, in theory, was this kind of, like, weird, trapped in a science ship sci-fi horror movie.
Yeah.
And then they were like, but what if it's Cloverfield? And they're like, oh, we gotta rewrite all this shit so we say Cloverfield 45 times.
Yeah. I feel like they didn't have to, though, because I feel like that was the whole point of this Cloverfield experiment, right? Is that you can just say it's a Cloverfield movie and people will be like, cool, I'll go see it. You don't have to say Cloverfield in the movie at all. Like,
no, just put in one shot of an alien and you're like, I'm in.
Yeah, that is Cloverfield. If there's a monster in it, like, for a brief second, you're good. You're good.
Yeah.
I will say, I mean, as far as the cast goes, I think Gugu Mbatha-Raw is kind of the lead of this movie, and she's good. Like, she's actually, I think, giving a pretty good performance. People know her, I think, best as for her episode of Black Mirror. She was in San Junipero. Elizabeth Zbecki is also good. The rest of this cast, I think, is given very little to do throughout the movie.
The Russian astronaut from The Martian's in it.
Is that who
he plays? He plays the Russian astronaut. Yes.
I thought I recognized him, and and it's because he's playing the exact same role. That's interesting. Yep.
He's got hair this time, though.
Yes, I did enjoy Chris O'Dowd, though, who is the comic relief of this movie, and he's the best part of everything he's in.
Yeah, but it felt so, that was like such this weird tonal thing for me, because like his character, like his one liners are great. I guess, but
okay. Well,
that's it.
I think he has the part that is the best part of the movie, and I'll talk about that in spoilers. So, is there any other like general stuff you want to get into, Mike, before we get into spoilers?
No. I think it's going to be much more fun to discuss specific things about this movie.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, let's move into spoilers for The Cloverfield Paradox, starting right now. Spoilers for The Cloverfield Paradox, starting right now. So, yeah, I did mention that Chris O'Dowd has the best part in this movie. He's just he's fixing something on the ship, and then suddenly the wall just, like, sucks in his arm.
Yeah.
And he barely reacts. He's just like, huh.
Oh, no.
This is weird. This is weird. And then when he pulls his arm, and then he pulls away, and his arm is gone. And he just doesn't have an arm for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But then, like, a few minutes later, you see his arm, and it's just walking around the ship. and it's amazing.
Like, it's great, and it's clearly an Evil Dead reference. And like, you know, like the hand walking and all that stuff. And it's amazing and hilarious. But, like, why, though? I don't understand.
I didn't, that was easily the best part of the movie for me. That was it's just that little, like, bit with his arm. There's a bit where the arm is, like, trapped under a box, and he's, like, motioning to get a pen. And it's like, the arm is trying to tell us something. And they, like, hand the arm a pen, and it's like writing things down. It's like, don't trust Schmidt or something.
How does it know? The arm knows to cut open the other dude.
Right.
Why does his arm have its own brain? Like, why is it sentient? I don't understand. I'm asking for a lot of science in this kind of movie, but like, just some internal logic.
I think the problem is that this movie fundamentally misunderstands what a paradox is. So,
it's just goofy shit, right?
It's just goofy shit happening over and over again. Right. So I think, you know, the idea behind this is these guys fire up this particle accelerator and end up in some kind of alternate dimension that it very closely mirrors our own. But because they also exist in our dimension, in that dimension, like, there's versions of themselves. So they can't also exist, right? They can only be one.
Right.
I believe that's what this movie's going for. And so because of that, like, weird shit just starts happening on the ship. And that's like... That's basically it. So you have that arm thing happening. You have the Russian guy exploding with worms in his stomach. That's never explained.
Nope. The woman shows up in the wall.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, that was pretty cool, though. I was on board up till then.
That was a great visual. And I was like, oh, really curious. Like, oh, how did that happen? And stuff like that. And then the movie just kind of keeps going. It's like, that doesn't really answer my question.
Nope.
But yeah, she wakes up, she's like in the wall, and she's like has like pipes coming out of her body and stuff like that, because she's like in the piping, and it's like, oh, this is fucked up. That's like the Cronenbergian horror shit that like I want to see more of in this movie. And then it kind of like peters out around the halfway mark. But yeah, I do like that arm thing, though. I really enjoyed the arm. that's the best part of the movie.
That's it. That's
Chris,
the whole thing.
Chris O'Dowd talking to his own arm, being like, oh, what do you think, arm?
It's basically a buddy cop movie for a second.
Like, he should have been the main character, and it should have been, like, him and his arm solving mystery on their own. Oh, it could have been amazing. But yeah.
I thought it was funny because there's a moment earlier, you know, kind of during the exposition part of the movie where the main character and her husband are talking, and he's like, "Oh, we can't go back in time and bring the kids back," or something like that, or whatever. Yeah. And it's like, "Oh, it's gonna be one of those paradoxes, huh?" And then, nope, we got another talking head who's what's that actor's name?
That's Donald Logue, right?
Yeah,
Donald Logue, who's just a guy who wrote a book about, like, oh, paradoxes will bring aliens and monsters and stuff. And it's like, how do you know that? There hasn't been a paradox yet.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, it's that kind of paradox, which I get. Like, I thought that where I thought this movie was going, honestly, was it was going to explain, not that we need this, because like we said, Cloverfield was supposed to be this weird kind of unconnected anthology sci-fi horror thing.
Right.
Or that's what we thought. But it was going to explain why the monsters were different in Cloverfield versus 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Okay. Like, well, I think it kind of does that almost. Or at least it serves as connective tissue for the whole franchise.
Yeah. Well, I guess the whole thing is going to be like, these are all vignettes in different dimensions, I guess, is what we're going to be doing.
So, yeah. I think the movie kind of gives background and connective tissue to the Cloverfield franchise as a whole. So as a result of the events of this movie, apparently monsters can appear at any time in any dimension, basically. So every Cloverfield movie, I think, is a different dimension.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So they all take place in different time periods, and so monsters just show up whenever. And so, yeah, it seems like a lot of explanation for a question that no one was asking.
Nope.
Like, not even a little bit.
Like, you know, where I thought this was going to go also was that, oh, they're, you know, they go to the other dimension, they land on that Earth, and that Earth has the Cloverfield monsters shit going on, and they're, oh, they save the day, whatever, and they go return to normal Earth, and it's fine. And,
well, I was convinced when they were at the end of the movie, like, they were kind of crash landing onto Earth, right? I was convinced that was going to segue into the shot from the original Cloverfield of the couple on the Ferris wheel, and you see, like, a small asteroid kind of going into the lake behind them.
Right.
I was convinced that it was going to end like that, and it didn't. And I was genuinely shocked. Like,
Yeah.
if you're going to tie it back to Cloverfield, I feel like that would have been the way to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. 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 That would have been awesome, and I would not have remembered that, but that would have been so cool. I wouldn't have remembered it till I saw it, probably. Because that's one of the things too, that Cloverfield, like you said, is earlier, is mostly just a series of successful marketing campaigns. You know, that ARG that happened, their alternate reality game before the first one, where it was all these websites and you know, as fake companies posting about this stuff and message boards and all this stuff, you know, about the satellite that fell out of the sky, which I think is that first shot or something like that. But you know, this whole kind of like alternate reality, figure out the mystery of how what this monster is and where it came from and all this stuff. It was a lot of fun. I wasn't like super into it, but I do remember like kind of deep diving on this, the internet when that came out as a young kid, which is like scary. But, you know, this kind of like, is this all real type thing?
Right.
So that like to kind of just get rid of all that stuff, like it was weird kind of like disregard all of it.
The thing is about these Cloverfield movies, like these things have been in there for a while, and there are like there's like strict mythology in these like ARG games. But the thing is, that's all marketing. The movies don't have any of that.
Like absolutely.
Yeah, like the original Cloverfield is just a monster movie. Cloverfield Lane is just like this survival movie in the shelter. And this movie is like just a sci-fi movie until it kind of decides it wants to explain why Cloverfield happens in every dimension or something. And it's like, you don't need that. You don't need this. You know, we were satisfied. We were good. Because the easiest explanation is just like, these are Cloverfield movies, but they don't have anything to do with each other. Like, they just say Cloverfield. It's like Twilight Zone. Get used to it. And like that
would have been so cool.
That would have been fun. And I think it can still be that. It's just now we have this movie that kind of tells you like, oh, well, this is why all this is happening. And it's like, I don't need that. Don't need it.
Yeah, we don't need it.
Yeah. But yeah, I do want to talk about, I did want to mention briefly I did really like the scene where Zhang Ziyi, the Chinese astronaut, when she dies in the airlock as it's flooding.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was pretty cool. That was a pretty cool death scene. It was a cool visual because, like, the water's filling up with the airlock, and then suddenly the airlock lets out and, like, into the vastness of space, and the water immediately freezes, and she dies beside it. Like, that was very cool. I like that a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool like moments, and like you're saying, like kind of body horror, like that sort of is body horror, I guess. Like being flash frozen, right?
and the
Russian astronaut looking in the mirror and like getting scared and his eye going in like a different direction and like being stuck there. That was fucking and like I wish it had lived up to the promise of those moments, if it had stuck with and just gone that kind of like B horror just like owned it and did it.
Yeah,
it would have been so cool.
If it wasn't ashamed of being Event Horizon, you know. If it could just be Event Horizon, you know. Event Horizon has no illusions about what it is. You know what I mean?
No. There's a demon blood orgy in Event Horizon. Like, it's not fucking around.
Man, we should watch Event Horizon sometime.
We should absolutely watch Event Horizon. But yeah, like, you know, there's kind of the worms thing is sort of like Alien, right? You know, kind of like a reminiscent of that. So like it's making like winks and nods to all these things that it wants to be or wants you to recognize. But then we just get this. We get that last shot.
That last shot, which is one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Wait, before we get there though, because I definitely want to discuss it. But I want to discuss who is Molly and why is she important?
Which one? The kid? Is Molly
the little kid that he saves.
Are they
in the shelter from 10 Cloverfield Lane?
It looks just like it, right?
Who's he texting about needing to use the shitter? Who, like, what is... Like...
Yeah, so there is this B-plot with the husband and the husband of Gugu and Beth of the Ross character, and he finds this kid. Kid's name is Molly. And, it is completely pointless. I think it undermines the movie, actually, because, you know, the first half of this movie is about the space station crew losing Earth. Like, how do you lose Earth, right? That's the big thing. Like, they lost Earth. They have no visual of Earth. They have no idea what happened to Earth. But it keeps cutting back to this husband on Earth, so you know that Earth is fine.
Right. Well, I don't think I was ever the worry was that Earth was in danger. It was mostly that they lost Earth.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, like, if you keep cutting back to Earth, then you know that, like, Earth is there somewhere. You know?
Right. Okay. That's fair.
And
yeah.
So, and it's not, and Earth isn't fine because there's a monster invasion happening at the same time, which is the big twist at the end of the movie, by the way. Earth is there. So, but at this point, you think Earth is basically fine. You kind of know that something's up, you know, and they go into a shelter and stuff like that. For that first half of the movie, like you keep cutting back to Earth, while the characters in the space station are like, oh man, where did Earth go? And it's like, hey, look for the sun. Like, please, just look for the sun.
There's a lot of stars out there, man.
I know, but, I would think your first instinct, if you lost Earth, would be what's around Earth? You know? You can look for
anyone
the sun.
Anyone seen my Tesla? Somebody's just out there with a key fob.
Exactly. Yeah.
Topical.
It was topical. It would be amazing if Elon Musk just made a cameo in this movie driving like a red Ferrari.
It's like,
so long, suckers.
Yeah, but I kind of was on board sort of with the flashing back to Earth stuff or whatever, the cutting back to Earth. Because, you know, it's sort of escalating, right? Like, there's those explosions, and it's the husband trying to figure out are we being bombed, and you know the fighter jets flying past his window, and like that kind of stuff. And it's like kind of winks and nods at what's going on and what we've like, you know, kind of at it's winking at Cloverfield, the first one. And I was kind of down for sort of that, like sort of like as now that they've kind of opened this rift or whatever. But then like he goes out there. And like that shadow moves in the smoke cloud.
Right, yeah.
And you're like, ugh, really? Okay. And then he finds Molly, who I was like, is this Mary Elizabeth Winstead as a child? Like, is that her character? I had to go look up what her character's name was, and it's not. It's Michelle or something like that.
I actually had to look up John Goodman's character's name because he asked if they can go to like this guy's shelter. And I think it's a guy named like Rick or something. And like I was like, is Rick John Goodman's name? Because John Goodman had a shelter in 10 Cloverfield Lane. Like because it's a Cloverfield movie, like my mind is like jumping to like make these connections to other Cloverfields. But then they get to the shelter, and it looks just like John Goodman's shelter from 10 Cloverfield Lane.
I like literally when he turned the light on, I actually yelled, "I fucking knew it!" Like I actually was like, "Yeah, okay, here we go." That's like what they're gonna use to as like the image to connect everything.
Yeah. But the character's name is different, and like, but I don't know. Maybe it is the same shelter, but it's a different dimension. Like, who knows?
I don't. Who knows? Yeah, it's super weird.
It could just be a visual reference. Like, maybe that shelter will appear in all the Cloverfield movies from now on. Like, Who knows?
Yeah.
That same Charles Earl appear in the World War II Cloverfield movie and it'll look exactly the same as all the modern amenities. Actually, that kind of shit could happen in a Cloverfield movie.
That'd be kind of cool, actually. There's like this one room that exists in all places.
Oh, man. That would be wild.
You're welcome, JJ.
We'll take our check in the form of a check, please. Anyway, we got to talk about the last shot, though. The last shot of the movie is just absolutely ridiculous. Like, I think it is not only one of the worst shots I've ever, like, just in terms of, like, I'm not saying it's bad in, like, a cinematography kind of way. I just think it's, like, a big fuck you to, to everything. Because the end of the movie is it's Gugu Mbatha-Raw and Daniel Brühl, right? They're still in the satellite, and they're crash landing back down on Earth, and they think it's their own Earth, right? Yeah, it is their Earth.
Yeah, because the husband.
Because she's calling the husband, and he's like, oh, no, you, or she's not calling.
Oh, no, they,
he's talking
they
to the
call...
space station.
Yes. No, they call Mission Control, and then Mission Control tells the husband, yeah.
Right, and he's like, you can't send her back down here. And it's like, what do you want us to do? Keep her, they're going to run out of oxygen and stuff. And it's like, doesn't she know what's coming down here? And then it cuts back, and you see the satellite kind of crash landing through space, and then suddenly a gigantic monster pops up. I believe it's the monster from the original movie.
It's the Cloverfield monster, the first one.
It's the Cloverfield monster. It pops up, and it screams, cut credits. Like, it's just...
Yeah.
And it's like, what? I couldn't stop laughing. I laughed so hard when that came up. Because it's just such a, like, what?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what they could have done to save that moment. But, the Mission Control calls the husband and is like, they're coming back to Earth. We didn't have time to explain what's going on. They were everything was falling apart. We couldn't tell them. There was nothing we could do. We're so sorry, like that. And the husband's like, there's the things. Tell them to go back. The things, though. There's creatures. And then we get that stupid scene. But when the satellite comes back and they can reestablish communication, there's like a long time where they're like, did the machine work? Tell us, are you guys alive? What's happening? Like, they kind of like have a conversation for a little while.
So they could have brought up the fact that monsters are overrun society, basically. Right?
I feel like if monsters are attacking, like... maybe someone would have mentioned that, like, right? Like, how come Mission Control is just fine? nothing happened there. It's cool. It's the everything's fine here. How are you seeing? Like,
yes,
like that's what's going on.
Yeah, but that was just ridiculous. I mean, I tweeted about how that last scene was the funniest shit of all time, and you tweeted a gif of Robin Williams and Mrs. Doubtfire with makeup on, like popping out of a fridge, going like hello, and like that's exactly what this is. It is just that.
Yeah. Yeah, it just pushes his head up through the clouds and roars. And, like, remember me? And then cuts the credits.
Remember me? Yeah. It was ridiculous. And overall, I think the Cloverfield Paradox is not a particularly good movie.
We didn't give it quite the full Chappie, but we came close.
The full Chappie?
Well, the full / Filmcast Chappie.
Yeah, I was going to say.
We liked Chappie.
Gave Chappie a pretty positive review when we saw that back in the day. It's just a little disappointing, right? Because, you know, Cloverfield 10 Cloverfield Lane are movies I really enjoy. I own both those movies on Blu-ray. I probably will not, I doubt there will be a Blu-ray of Cloverfield Paradox because it is Netflix original now.
Yeah.
But even if there was a Blu-ray, I don't think I would pick it up. I think it would be a fun movie to watch with a big group. Kind of thing, like Event Horizon, like something like that. And I think if you watched like these three movies back to back to back, like I think I could see having fun with Cloverfield Paradox for sure. It's not really a good movie in its own right, and it's really goofy, which is fine, but it doesn't really own its goofiness in any way, shape, or form. So when it tries to be serious, it's like, well, what are you doing? Like,
yeah, like the inevitable betrayal of. Oh man, the blonde woman. I don't remember her character's name.
Becky.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember her character's name. She's all like, she does great. David Oluwayo.
Oyelowo.
Is cool. Daniel Brühl is fun. Like,
there
are good performances and there are fun stuff going on. But like,
they have good cast. And Elizabeth Debicki, especially. I mean, she was in Man from U.N.C.L.E. She was in the Guardians of the Galaxy 2. She was the Gold Woman, Aisha.
Yeah.
She's in a lot of good stuff. She's a very good actress, and I think she's given the most outside of Gugu Mbatha-Raw, I feel like she is given the most to work with.
Yeah.
But even then, I feel like this movie kind of wastes her, too. It's just, it feels like everybody's there just like functionally, I guess, instead of like,
yeah.
There's no actual character development for anybody.
I mean, for like a good 3/4 of the movie, she's literally in the corner in the back of the frame.
Yeah.
Like in that med bay thing, just yes. Like back there hanging out. And it's just like, that's it. Just chilling.
Yeah, exactly. So I think overall, just give me more weird shit. You know, give me more of that. Give me
own what you're doing.
Yeah, give me more disembodied arms. Give me more worms exploding out of bodies. Give me Elizabeth and Becky suddenly appearing in pipes. Like, that's the shit that I enjoyed in this movie. And when this movie starts to lose that stuff at around the halfway mark, I think that's when it all starts to fall apart. Because then it's still trash, but it's not like goofy fun trash.
Yeah. You know? When it has to be the backbone for a franchise, not so great.
Does not work.
No.
All right, and I think that wraps up our thoughts on the Cloverfield Paradox, Mike, which I don't think we even got into the fact that that's kind of a dumb title. Like, I will say 10 Cloverfield Lane, not a great title either, but the movie's good enough where it's like, that's fine. If the movie is good enough, then the title becomes good. You know what I mean?
I think 10 Cloverfield Lane might end up doing a disservice to the Cloverfield franchise because it's too good. Like, I mean, I haven't seen the original Cloverfield in a long time.
Neither have I, but I really liked it back in the day.
I remember liking it, but I don't particularly remember it being like that level. Like, it's a monster movie. It's not like monster cinema, you know. I think I would consider 10 Cloverfield Lane to be cinema, you know.
Sure. If you want to describe it in the most pretentious way possible, absolutely, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. You could hear me twirling my mustache when I said that. I don't know. I'm interested to see how that kind of reflects or shapes the rest of the franchise or things constantly trying to live up to 10 Cloverfield Lane, if that is going to be a thing. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I mean, we will find out, I guess, at some point this year if Cloverlord becomes a thing. Hashtag Cloverlord. It's happening, baby.
Start it.
And I think that one's supposed to actually hit theaters, so I think they might have more confidence in what that one is than this. I'm curious what this will mean for Netflix going forward. I mean, Netflix paid $50 million for this Cloverfield movie. The budget for this was about $45 million. So Paramount made back their money. Like, and I think that's all they were concerned with, because I think they really thought this movie was going to bomb horribly. So this worked out really well for Paramount. And for Netflix, I don't know, it almost makes Netflix feel like a video-on-demand dumping ground. You know, for, like, if a studio wants to, like, pawn off a movie or something, they can sell it to Netflix, and Netflix will pay for it. And I get that. And there's been a couple of movies recently that kind of make it feel like that. You know, like, Bright, for example, is another one that feels like, okay, this is a Netflix movie, and people will like it, or people will watch it. And there's been, like, you know, people who will, like, be defending Bright and people who are defending this movie. And I think most of that is just out of the convenience of it being at your house. Like, it's just, it's right there.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of those kind of on-demand movies, you know, are still, like, is pay-per-view still a thing, sort of? Like, you know, if I'm going to rent a movie for 10 bucks and watch it, and that's the only way it's come out, I'd probably still be mad that I had to pay $10 to watch this kind of movie.
100%.
But I get 18 million movies for $10 a month from Netflix.
And one of them's a Cloverfield. Like,
yeah, like, I'm in. I'm down, sure. Yeah.
And things like Netflix shouldn't be considered a video dumping ground, like, because they have a lot of great original movies. You know, they have, you know, they had Okja, and they had Meyerowitz Stories, and they had I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, and, you know, Beast of No Nation, and they've got Mutes coming out in a couple of weeks. I'm very excited about Mutes, and, you know, all that stuff. But I think the problem is Netflix has no real standard for what they release. They just make a shitload of stuff. And
eventually some of it sticks.
Yeah, eventually, like, some of it's good, some of it's bad, and a lot of it's, you know, middling to mediocre, and that's kind of the way it is. Some stuff will take off, some of them won't, but they just make everything for every person, and I feel like that's fine, but I feel like it almost devalues Netflix as a brand almost, because they're not, you know, they're not catering their stuff towards what they think people will want to see. They're just making everything.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is interesting too, though, that they finally did the dream, though, of day and date. Like, we announced the movie today, and you can watch it today.
Yes,
Which is crazy. I know people have been clamoring for that. The next big thing is, not that people like want that, but that's an incredible feat. The next big thing is Netflix theater same day, not not that they come out, they are announced on the same day and are released the same day, but that they hit both platforms at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Which could be, I don't know, maybe that's around the corner.
Yeah, I mean, that really is a game changer, though. Like, this is a game changer in terms of movie releases, and I don't know how often we'll ever see this again. Like, this is something that's very rare in other media. Like, other media, you see this sometimes, where, like, Beyonce will surprise release a new album, or Radiohead will surprise release a new album. But it's never happened for movies before. It's never been possible for movies before, really.
Yeah.
I think the closest we had come was a couple years ago when 10 Cloverfield Lane did it. And
two months or whatever it was we've ever gotten.
Yeah, it was like 6 weeks, and it was a movie we already knew was being made, but then we didn't know it was Cloverfield. And then there was another, later that year, there was Blair Witch also, which was, called The Woods for the longest time until it was suddenly revealed at Comic-Con, actually, that it was a Blair Witch movie while they screened it. So that's actually probably the closest it has come to this, at least for one audience, you know, because that audience got to experience Blair Witch without knowing it was a Blair Witch movie until they were watching it. Like they thought they were seeing a movie called The Woods. And so that's probably the closest that it has come to what just happened with this Cloverfield movie. And it's a bummer that this Cloverfield movie isn't better, that it lives up to this game changing marketing technique, you
know? Yeah, I mean, to do it during the Super Bowl, that's the biggest like marketing platform there is in
Absolutely,
the country,
yeah.
At least. So I mean, it's incredible that Netflix paid or made literally one 30-second ad for something they spent $50 million on,
right? But it worked. Like, people have been talking about this movie for a week. Like,
yes, yeah, exactly.
You know, a lot of people have watched. If you go on Letterboxd, and obviously that's just a niche, a percent of people. It's, you know, people who are really into movies and stuff. But if you go on Letterboxd, everybody watched it. Just like straight up, everybody watched The Cloverfield Paradox. You know, and it's one, like, we were lucky because we weren't sure what we were going to review this week. And suddenly there's a surprise Cloverfield movie. And we were like, well, shit.
That's it. Problem solved.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that about wraps up our thoughts on The Cloverfield Paradox. It's not a great movie. It does have some fun elements in it for sure. In an Event Horizon kind of way. Really just watch Event Horizon. But if you're in a pinch and if you happen to be scrolling through Netflix and this is the only thing that you can see, if Netflix shuts everything down and this is the only movie they have left.
Yeah, if Netflix has taken Event Horizon off of itself, then watch Cloverfield Paradox. But last time I checked.
Is Event Horizon on Netflix?
That's where I watched it. I mean, but that was years ago now. But I mean, it might be. I don't know. They usually have those kind of things up there.
Okay.
Check it out. Search Event Horizon. This will probably come up in the related to, and just watch it.
Yeah. It really, all this movie did was make me want to watch Event Horizon. That's literally
100%.
Anyway, so I think that about wraps up our thoughts. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at
the Event Horizon Fan Club. P.O. Box 212.
I was thinking of the tagline. Cloverfield Paradox. Just watch Event Horizon. you can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons and Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog. All of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, you can find some of my work at crookedmarquee.com as well. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCrescio. If you're listening via our podcast on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast. God damn it. Why are you laughing at me, man?
Oh, man. Why does this copy always make me laugh?
I have no idea. It's the most boring part of the show.
Because if you change a syllable of it once, that's it. It's hilarious. It's the best thing.
if I read one thing off, then derails the entire thing. Yeah. Review it. Feedback, compliments, all that stuff. Email us, podcast@filmbook.com. We want to hear from you. Now, join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where I think we'll be talking Black Panther. Right, Mike? I mean, that's coming out in 2 weeks, and I'm really excited about it.
That's the plan, as long as we can both see it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely real excited about that. The reviews have been coming in, and they've been very positive. I love Ryan Coogler, so I'm very excited to see what he can do in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we are talking Nicolas Cage's role in Mike's favorite movie of all time, 2009's Knowing.
I quit.
Just straight up, the podcast is over now.
That's it.
You knew this day would come, Mike. You knew this would come.
It was a planned end date. I didn't tell you about it. But when we got to knowing, we've gone too far.
Yeah, well, I'll try to convince him to do it at some point. Thanks so much for listening, guys. We are
last night I watched this movie, not commercial free. Interrupted the flow when two hoes getting pissed at me. I'm getting screwed by the cable company. Paying money for ads, now that's a motherfucking tragedy. Heard about this Netflix, so cheap. We can watch it anywhere, so sweet. We go Netflix all night, no sleep. These hoes ain't going nowhere tonight. Cause tonight everything is on stream. No ads in between. The movies, the sitcoms, you get a month free. Critics picks, award winners, suggestions for me. Then show me some genres of more related movies. Now browse DVDs.
No cable, just streaming. It's a queue on the screen all weekend.